Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Fennec corporate presentation. My name is Rusty Rakoff, and I am the CEO of Fennec. These are the regular forward-looking statements. I won't repeat them. Cisplatin has been widely used in pediatrics since the 1980s. And if you speak to a pediatric oncologist and ask them what is the biggest issue with using cisplatin, 10 out of 10 likely would say it's hearing loss or ototoxicity. Cisplatin is a very effective drug. It does a great job in reducing the tumor size, shrinking it, or eliminating it in many cases. And it has been optimized throughout the 80s for various solid tumors in pediatrics. They've achieved fantastic survival. In many cases, you have greater than 80% survival in these children. But quality of life, I would say, in the last 5 years or so, has really become a big issue for these treating physicians. Because the survival comes at a cost, and in many cases the cost is the child losing their hearing. Fennec is a US-based company. We're in North Carolina. We're developing a unique formulation of a drug called sodium thiosulfate for the prevention of this hearing loss. We have a orphan drug designation, which is pediatric in nature, which gives us 7.5 years of market exclusivity. And we are eligible for PUMA, which is pediatric use marketing authorization in Europe, which would give us 10 years of data exclusivity. So, in the last decade, since I've been involved in this company, we have worked with two cooperative groups to do studies in pediatric oncology. As a pharmaceutical company, is challenging because the patients see networks of hospitals that are linked in through cooperative groups, and they largely study different various diseases. So we have been fortunate enough to have worked with the two predominant networks in pediatric oncology worldwide. The first one is Children Oncology Group, which is based out of the U.S., and we conducted a proof of concept study with them where we enrolled 135 patients. The study met definitively its primary endpoint for the prevention of the hearing loss. The study was published in Lancet Oncology a few years ago. The second study, we worked with another cooperative group in a tumor type called standard risk hepatoblastoma, which is liver cancer. It occurs in 13-month-old kids. The study also met its primary efficacy endpoint for prevention of hearing loss, and the study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Subsequent to that, we have also in Europe, we completed our pediatric investigational plan, which is a mini approval from the PDCO group under EMA. So now we'll be in a position to file with the CHMP for full approval. We also received from the FDA a breakthrough therapy designation and a fast track for PEDMARK, or our unique formulation of sodium thiosulfate, and we initiated a rolling submission with them last December, which we're hopeful to complete by early next year. What's really unique about PEDMARK is that it would be the first product ever with a label for the prevention of hearing loss. We have, up to this point, we have not had a drug that prevents hearing loss. So what we have today really is, for these kids, we have cochlear implants for the really severe hearing loss and hearing aids. So typically what these physicians go through every day when they see these patients is when they establish cisplatin as the main regimen to treat them is in many cases, as soon as the second dose comes, they the kids experience hearing loss. But by the time the fourth cycle comes, they are largely deaf. They lose their high frequency. They lose the ability to hear consonants. They lose the ability to hear background noise. I get a question sometimes asked, what is high frequency? High frequency is really the ability to hear alarms, really the ability to hear a mosquito, really the ability to understand when someone speaks clearly, because the whole speech mingles with the background noise. And it's highly problematic in very young children because they're in the process of acquiring language skills. So what ends up happening with them is that they have a real difficult time developing their IQ later in life. In the older kids, they go through the cisplatin therapy. We see a lot of depression, withdrawal. These kids have a very, very tough time continuing to go to school and participate with their classmates in any social activities or listening to music, given that their hearing is going away. So this slide here speaks to, so this is a disease called neuroblastoma. It occurs typically in children before the age of five. It's a really, really nasty disease. But many kids survive it with various side effects. Many of them obviously go deaf. And what this study has done here is that he has looked at these kids' long-term survivors of the disease and how they accomplished in school. So you could see from the histogram on the left, by the time they were in grade three, roughly a third of them were held back at least one grade. By the time they got to ninth grade, roughly half of them were held back at least one grade, which speaks to their achievement in school and how difficult it is for them to be in the classroom setting. So two factors really influence the degree of the hearing loss. One is obvious, is the cumulative cisplatin dose. So the more cisplatin you give these kids, the greater the hearing loss. The other one is the age of the kid. So really, before they become teens, they have a much greater risk of having that hearing loss. The population for these patients, so roughly every year in the United States, you have 5,000 kids diagnosed with solid tumors that go through platinum therapy. Roughly 90% of them are cisplatin and carboplatin in some tumors. The rest of it is carboplatin. Carboplatin is not as effective as cisplatin, so cisplatin is really the drug of choice. There have been studies done with PD-1s in these tumors. PD-1s don't do a good job at all. So cisplatin will remain a mainstay therapy for these patients. So out of these 5,000 patients in the United States, roughly two-thirds of them are with a localized, non-metastatic disease. And you'll see based later on our clinical data why, and this is ultimately, we believe, the label for our drug, why we believe the great benefit for that population is such that you have very high survival and where quality of life really, really matters for these kids. Versus for metastatic or disseminated disease, the survival is less than 50%. And therefore, quality of life may not be as important as actually treating the tumor first. So, sodium thiosulfate, it's a grandfathered compound. It's been around for a very long time, really since World War I. We have a unique formulation of the compound, and it's the only sodium thiosulfate that has been studied in two randomized studies in pediatrics and has obviously market exclusivity there. Obviously, has shown an effect on the prevention of the hearing loss definitively. Mechanistically, how it works is that cisplatin has a very, very short half-life. It's roughly 20 to 30 minutes. Sodium thiosulfate must be given 6 hours after the cisplatin infusion. It cannot be given together. Sodium thiosulfate binds to platinum complexes. In the inner ear, platinum accumulates at a much slower rate than the rest of the body. When sodium thiosulfate comes, it binds irreversibly to it and it excretes it out. Again, it's very important that the 6 hour window is obeyed. Sodium thiosulfate is also IV and it's given over 15 minutes. So this is our first study, which is with the Children Oncology Group. The study was a proof of concept study. It's really the close thing to a real life study where physicians see patients of various ages, various tumor types that required cisplatin therapy as part of a multi-drug regimen per the investigator. What is very important is not only to realize the heterogeneity of this population, but also the fact that these patients were not stratified for risk up front before they enrolled in the study. The primary aim of the study was to measure the hearing loss of the patients that got STS versus the patients that did not get STS. And the secondary endpoint, the important one, is to monitor on the event-free survival and overall survival given the heterogeneity of the population. So this is very clearly shows the groups of children, the ages, the distribution between those, as well as the tumor types. The various tumor types that they tried to randomize by. Again, keep in mind that there was no risk group stratification up front for these tumors. And then you could see the extent of the disease. Some were with a localized non-metastatic disease, which is roughly two-thirds, versus the one-third was with disseminated metastatic disease. This is the hearing loss for these patients, the primary endpoint, which basically sodium thiosulfate reduced the risk of the hearing loss by half. 56% had hearing loss versus 29%. There was a predefined subgroup analysis of looking at the youngest patients, which are the ones 5 and under, and you could see there that 73% had hearing loss versus 21%. So it reduces the hearing loss by even greater magnitude than the 50% in the overall population, which sort of makes sense given that the impact is the greatest in the younger patients. When they looked at the event-free survival and overall survival, there was no difference between these heterogeneous groups. However, what they saw in overall survival after a year and a half is that the curve started separating to the detriment of STS. So they did a post hoc analysis, meaning they tried to see what potentially could be causing this separation. And out of all the data they collected in the CRF, the only thing they could find is that patients with metastatic disease seem to have done worse on STS than the patients that did not take STS. Patients with localized disease, there was no difference, which obviously raised the concern about the safety of using STS in this subgroup analysis. What's really interesting to us, again, to point you out to, is that, number one, it's a post hoc analysis, but secondly, if you look at the survival curve here, at 3 years for these tumor types, on the observation group is roughly 80%. Compare that to the localized red curve, which is about 80% as well at 3 years. This is what you would expect for localized tumors. What typically you expect for metastatic tumors based on literature and every disease is roughly 50%, which is what STS came in at. So we think that upfront, when the study was, given that the study was not, was randomizing just by disease, but not by disease extent, it's very likely that STS got patients up front that were sicker and had worse prognosis. We have a second study, which is quite important to answer the question, at least in localized disease, as to what the potential impact of STS may or may not be. That study was done with SIOP, which is the large international pediatric network, the liver group underneath that. So here was studied in one disease. So So all the heterogeneity is removed from the study. This is only liver cancer in one age group. These kids are 1.3 years, 13 months old on average. Cisplatin is used as a monotherapy here, which is really, really important because you don't have a multi-drug regimen. What's also very nice about this study is that this tumor type, the standard risk hepatoblastoma disease, responds extremely well to cisplatin. The disease is very, very sensitive to it. So you have greater than 90% survival for these kids. And therefore, quality of life really, really matters for them. In addition, there is an AFP tumor marker. And what the AFP tumor marker does is that you can monitor the patient very, very well. And as the AFP starts going up, then the physician could decide to basically stop the use of STS. They could also add doxorubicin to the regimen and get a very, very high survival outcome. So it's a very, very clean study in the sense that it's done in a very homogeneous population, and these kids were stratified up front based on risk factors. So there was no, so you were not comparing across tumor types, and you are not comparing across severity of the disease. Everything was done the proper way up front. So this is the schema of the study. So cisplatin was given for 4 cycles. Then there was typically there's surgery for these tumors, and then there's 2 more cycles of cisplatin, and then the 90% of these kids live versus the group that got obviously cisplatin. 6 hours later, they get STS. So that was the comparison between the two. This is the hearing data from the study, very confirmatory of what we had in the COG study. 63% of these patients had hearing loss versus 32.7. Again, the magnitude is roughly reduces the risk of hearing loss by half. This is across different grading, and you could see that STS helps these kids, prevents the hearing loss regardless of the grade. This is the important one where they looked at event-free survival and overall survival for these patients, and there was no difference between the two groups, the one that got STS versus the one that did not get STS. So this data got published in New England Journal of Medicine. Subsequent to that, there was an editorial where the investigators from COG, as well as the investigators from SIOP, wrote to the editor as to how potentially the PEDMARK could be used in practice. And you could see from the discussion there, that they're quite complementary for the drug use in localized non-metastatic disease. Also on our website, there is a presentation by Dr. David Fryer, who's the head of the supportive care at COG, who speaks at the last SIOP meeting in Kyoto last year, where he also makes recommendations as to how the drug would be used in localized non-metastatic disease. We also had a patient-focused drug development meeting. I highly encourage anyone who would consider investing in our company to listen to this presentation. It's a 4-hour presentation. It was done in front of FDA officials. It happened last year, and these were really long-term survivors of the cisplatin therapy and shared their stories and what it's like to live with this hearing loss. We also had some patients that were part of these studies that were lucky enough to randomize to STS, and they shared their stories of what it's like to not have hearing loss and minimum hearing loss and participate in their active setting have a regular life, basically. So where we are from a regulatory perspective, we have submitted, we have with the FDA, we have started on a rolling submission. We are, the last section of our submission unfortunately got delayed. We had a our manufacturer that was manufacturing our API or starting material was bought by a larger company. The larger company required us to change sites. We successfully changed the sites of the manufacturing, and with that we had to transfer the manufacturing process to a larger commercial site. That all took place last quarter, and it's behind us. We have manufactured drug now, and drug is on stability. So now we're waiting for certain timelines for this stability to show that obviously the drug is stable. We had made it before. We're highly confident that the new manufacturing process, that the new facility that manufactured the drug has done a good job, and we're just waiting now, and we expect to finish the submission of the NDA by the end of the year. Oh, sorry, early next year. This is our capital structure. It's a little less than 20 million shares outstanding. This is our shareholder list. Most of these investors have been with us for a very, very long time. The second largest shareholder there is the investment arm of a company called Sigma Tau, which is a private Italian company, a rare disease company. When they made the investment, they knew very well the pediatric oncology space because they were involved in Oncaspar, which is a drug sold to the hematological piece of in pediatric cancer. So they actually did quite a bit of research on us, and they made a substantial investment, and they subsequently also joined our board, Dr. Marco Bruguera. The nice thing about our company is that you probably would not meet a less capital-intensive company in biotech that is largely de-risked. We have $17.5 million in cash. Last quarter, we burned $3 million, and that's with heavy manufacturing expenses. We also have a $12.5 million debt facility arranged that now sub 6%. Again, we really care about protecting the equity and not doing unnecessary dilution. That facility is available to us upon approval to help us augment the cost for the launch of PEDMARK. And this is our board of directors that are actually quite experienced. Our chairman and Adrian Hake were together at Gentium, which, again, did very, very well. Part of the indication was for VOD in pediatrics, where these kids go through stem cell transplant, and many of them obviously have the solid tumors that also have been treated with cisplatin and cause hearing loss. So they knew the space quite well. So they have been a terrific addition to our board, as well as Chris Rallis, who's been quite experienced and has been with us for since I've been involved in the company in the last 10 years. Management team is very, we're just a small team. We make sure that we keep to spending money at minimal amount possible, keep the dilution down, get to a position where we get the drug approved, and we're obviously in a position to launch the drug without. Again, what's unique about our product is that it's not very capital intensive. Most of these drugs, when they get launched, they require a tremendous amount of capital up front. This one does not. We worked with most pediatric hospitals in the U.S. and Europe and Japan and Australia and New Zealand and Canada. So they know our product very, very well. They know what our product can do and not do. These drugs typically go on a specific disease protocols. So once they go on these protocols, they're mandatory in how they're used. Given the strength of these data sets, we believe that sodium thiosulfate will ultimately make it to most of these protocols and physicians would use it. And because of that, it obviously does not require a big sales commercial infrastructure in place. So with that, I have 5 minutes and I'll open up to questions.
Yes. Based on other things that are sold, what do you think, what would you project would maybe be the price that the drug gets sold at?
So the question is, what do I project the price to be? So So if you look at, so there are two metrics to this that we look at, and we've done actually quite a bit of studies around that health economic argument, and we're really looking at it from a European perspective because we actually think the U.S. healthcare system is moving in that direction. And what is the benefit of using this drug versus not using it? And so what we have today, unfortunately, are suboptimal hearing aids and cochlear implants. A hearing aid basically costs about $1,000 a year, and you have to replace it every 4 years. A cochlear implant costs about, depends if it's unilateral or bilateral, but you have to replace it every 11 to 15 years and costs about $100,000 in the U.S. You could go to videos on YouTube and type in what does a child hear with those devices, and you could hear a normal hearing versus with those devices. And when I say suboptimal, they're really suboptimal. We have a prevention of the hearing loss. So that should give you some guidance, if you will, around potential pricing vis-a-vis a cochlear implant and vis-a-vis the lifelong cost of a hearing aid. Also, what's interesting to say about this is that in 2011, there was a study published in Canada, and Canada is a single-payer system where they looked at their solid tumors in pediatrics treated with cisplatin. And what was the impact, the cost of the Canadian healthcare system long-term, and they obviously did a present value calculation for this hearing loss. And what they found out is that the grade 3 and 4 hearing loss cost to the Canadian healthcare system $500,000. This study was not, no one in this study was paid by us, so this is fully independent. And then, again, gives you a point of reference. And by the way, by no means do I suggest that we'll charge $500,000 for this drug. Let me caveat it this way, though. Yes?
Are you still looking for the broad label, or did you see like initial guidance from the FDA?
So the question is around the label expectations from the FDA and what guidance we receive from them. We had our pre-NDA meeting with them. After the meeting, based on totality of the data and what when we looked at the data, what the data represented in, as a package, and based on the conversations we had with them, we decided to file for a localized non-metastatic disease. Obviously, that will be a review issue, and we'll come out on the other end either with that label or hepatoblastoma label. Any other questions? Well, thank you all for coming. I appreciate it.